All right, this afternoon we're going to begin a new Bible study series. I do thank those of you who gave me some suggestions. I did take note of those, and they did have some influence on what I eventually decided to do. But obviously, when I open it up and ask anyone who would like to make a suggestion, I can't use all the suggestions. I can only choose one at a time. And so this afternoon, we're going to begin a series. I'm going to be studying the minor prophets, better known in the Hebrew word as Hebrew world as the 12. Some time ago, we covered some of the minor prophets as part of an in-home series of Bible studies. But we did not have time to complete that study before things changed on us. So I know that a small number of you participated in some of, at least, those studies. So hopefully this time around there'll be a little bit of an improvement on what you heard the last time. And I don't think there are very many who were part of the entire series that we started. So we're going to begin discussing the minor prophets. Just as a kind of an aside, we will continue our pattern of having one Bible study each month. Generally speaking, it will be the third Sabbath of the month. And I'll try to remember to remind you or put it on the calendar or the schedule, so that if I provide you with any handouts during a previous study, it would be good to keep those. I know it's kind of hard to keep track of loose individual pieces of paper, but it would be good to have those with you as we continue. I probably will go back and refer to a handout that I had distributed in a previous study. With that in mind, I also plan to email you copies of the handouts so that if somehow you get separated from what you are given, you'll at least have an opportunity to go ahead and download that and print yourself another copy. We'll keep other copies at the table. It's just kind of, I kind of put you on the spot if I expect you to carry around with you all these handouts. But again, if you know that or expect we'll have it on the third week of the month, that'll give you some idea. Also, just as kind of a comment as well, since we have one Bible study a month, each for approximately an hour and a quarter or so, and we have 12 minor prophets, we will not take the time to go through each book word for word, but we will give a best effort to covering each book in enough detail so that you'll have a good understanding of what that book contains. In choosing this subject or this series, I was not sure, still not sure, what the next Foundation Institute online class is going to be. It's on the Book of Acts, but that was a close one. We'll see how that goes. The reason I say that is because if the new class should happen to be the minor prophets, then I would volunteer to bail out and let Dr. Levy cover that subject. But in this case, I guess they have to live up to my series. So today, our discussion will mostly be an introduction. And I'll admit at the outset that it might even be a little bit tedious because there'll be some history involved and some of the background of the men, the prophets, their times, and how God used them. So the study today is going to be mostly a discussion of a lot of background material that I hope will lay a foundation for our studies. I do have a handout, and maybe Lou can help me over here. Gary in the other side of the room, maybe. There clearly are plenty of copies. Now, whatever's left, just put on the information table, if you would, please. This is essentially a timeline, and it will help us to establish a little bit of a starting point or a context regarding the time of the prophets, when they did their work, and also a few just general benchmark dates to help us put things, again, in a context. When we read a book, especially we'll see with these 12 of the minor prophets, then it's good to have an idea of when it was written, to whom it was written, and some about the time or the conditions in the nation when these books were first written. Basically, the title of it is Chronological Order of the Prophets. let me point out, as far as the dates are concerned, you see on the left, it starts with 850. These are all dates B.C. And progresses across to the right. The dates that I have here on this chart are circa. Circa, you may be familiar if you see a date sometimes with a small c preceding the date. The c stands for circa, which is Latin for about or ish. The dates are not, if you look in other reference works, you will likely see other dates plus or minus 2 or 3 or 5 years. These dates are about correct. I don't know that anyone knows exactly when certain of these men lived and exactly when they did their work, but this gives us an idea. Many of the prophets, let's say Hosea as an example, Micah, I believe Amos, the very first verse of chapter 1 in their book tells you who the king was when they did their work. And that gives us, we can go back to other chronologies, and it gives us a range of time within which these prophets did their work. Might also point out that many of the reference works refer to these men as the writing prophets. There were other prophets whose work is not recorded in books. For example, Elijah and Elisha were major and important prophets in the history of Israel, but they weren't writing prophets. There's no book that records their work or their messages. So what we have here, and both the minor prophets or the major prophets as well, are books that were produced by what, for lack of a better term, are considered to be the writing prophets. They wrote books, or books were written of their works. I'll make a couple of comments or a few comments about the chronology itself. I know that it's a little bit tight. Look across that upper line, and you'll have to maybe study it a little bit to orient yourself to the way that it's laid out. Essentially, again, it goes from the left to the right, the 850 BC on the left to 400 BC on the right. The two top lines show the timeline of the minor prophets, or of the 12. Some of them overlap, so some of them are below the way they're presented here on the timeline, below others. It was too tight to try to squeeze all of the dates onto the same line. You'll also see a little further down the chart two other kinds of information. First of all, shows 721 to 718 is the time when Israel was taken into captivity. And to the right of that, 604 is when Judah was invaded for the first time by Babylon. There was a second invasion. Then in 585 was the final invasion of Babylon into Judah. In that year, in 585, the temple was destroyed. In year 538, Judah was released from captivity. And then in 515 was the completion of the rebuilding of the temple, or the second temple was completed in 515. If you compare that to what's above it, you see the context or the timing of when the prophets wrote in relation to these other significant events. Primarily, of course, the prophets warned of the punishment that came when Israel and Judah were, Israel was taken into captivity, Judah was invaded and taken captive as well. So you'll see when those events occurred in relation to the times of the minor prophets themselves. And then toward, and below that, you'll see the timing of the work of Isaiah, Jeremiah, Daniel, and Ezekiel. And again, these dates are approximate. Most of the referenced works would give dates very similar to these. But you see the work of Isaiah was from the year 740 to 680. Jeremiah was 626 to 585. Now, 585 is when Judah went into captivity. Jeremiah's work actually extended beyond that time. You remember that he took the king's daughters and they fled the area, even went into Egypt for a time. So the 585 is the end of his warning to the nation of Judah, although his personal work continued on beyond that. Daniel, you note, is given the dates of 604 to 535. Daniel was taken captive in the first wave or the first attack on Judah. He and other young men were taken back to Babylon and given special education. Remember, Daniel rose within the government to a prominent position based on his abilities and on that education that he received. Ezekiel is also shown. His work was primarily when he was among the captives in Babylon. So notice, just for example, that the prophets Amos, Hosea, and Micah all were contemporary with Isaiah. They worked in different parts of the country and the nation. There's no indication directly that they were aware of or had any connection to each other in the work or the message that they were taking. Just because it doesn't say so in Scripture doesn't mean they didn't have some awareness of each other, but we just don't know what that connection would have been or might have been. But basically, there's no crossover between their works, except in the case of there's a prophecy in Micah chapter 4, which is almost exactly word for word the same as one in Isaiah 2. Other than that, we don't know, although they were prophesying in about the same general time frame, that they were aware of each other's work. The same would be true of Jeremiah. You see that his work extended during the times of other of the prophets. Nahum, Zephaniah, Habakkuk were also prophets in both Israel and Judah during those times, during the same time as Jeremiah. On the timeline, way over on the left side, you have Joel at 850 and Jonah at 800. Those dates are, again, very much an estimate. There is no date given for either of those two prophets. However, there are other indications that they were very early compared to others of the minor prophets. In many cases, in fact, in most, we know very little about the men who wrote these books. There's a little bit of the personal life of Hosea, for example, that is included in his prophecies. And we know a little bit about Amos. We know that a little bit of his professional background, the work that he did. But for the most part, very little is known. In fact, in some cases, again, Hosea as an example, he's not mentioned anywhere else in Scripture. So we don't know a lot about many of those who wrote these particular books, and we'll talk about those as we continue. Primarily, the earlier prophets, Amos, Hosea, Micah, even Nahum but Zephaniah, were giving their warnings primarily to the nation of Israel. You see Israel's captivity there in 721 to 718. So all those to the left of that, Micah, Hosea, Amos, primarily focused on the nation of Israel. After Israel was taken into captivity, then the focus turned more to get warning of Judah. There are three categories into which these 12 prophets are divided, and they all have to do with the time of the captivity of Judah. The term that's used is exilic, E-X-I-L-I-C, exilic, which is derived from the word exile or captivity. So you have a number of books that were pre-exilic, in other words, written before Judah's captivity. And this is the largest group of the 12. There were pre-exilic, pre-captivity in terms of the nation of Judah. Now, these terms are not used so much for Israel, because Israel disappeared from the world scene after they were after their nation was taken over by Assyria. The people were scattered, and they did not reemerge immediately as a nation. So it's the term exilic is used to refer to Judah, because they did return from captivity and reestablish themselves as a people, though not so much as a nation. The pre-exilic prophets are Joel, Jonah, Amos, Hosea, Micah, Nahum, Zephaniah, and Habakkuk. 8 of the 12 are pre-exilic. There's one that is called an exilic prophecy because it was written at the time of the captivity. In the minor prophets, that would include Obadiah. By the way, the pre-exilic, if you want to include the major prophets, would also include Isaiah and Jeremiah. The post-exilic prophets are Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. And you may remember the book of Haggai is completely that takes place in a very short period of time. And the subject is the encouragement of the people to continue rebuilding the temple. Zechariah includes some of that as well, although it goes beyond that. So those three are the post-exilic. And you can see as you look at them that the subject matter is different depending on if they're written before or after the captivity of Judah. So that's kind of an overview of the prophets as they're shown on this timeline. Again, I just will point out that the purpose of this is just to give you an idea, if you're reading, for example, the book of Zephaniah, to understand when it was written, in relation to the other of the minor prophets gives you a little bit more of an understanding of the just knowing the timing of it and the context in terms of when it was written can be of some help in understanding a little bit more about the book. In a similar way, I've listed at the bottom of the page the kings of Israel and Judah. And this, again, is given mostly just as a matter of context. When you read through those books of Kings, 1 and 2 Kings, also 2 Samuel for that matter, you see this whole list of kings, and they kind of come and they go, and somebody's born while in the 15th year of somebody else's reign, and they kind of cross each other. So I think to look at them in a table form like this helps you to see the flow of the kings. And the years, again, are approximate. Some reigned for a lengthy period of time, others for a very short time. But it shows you the kings who ruled in Israel, and their in order, and their years are, again, circa, approximately. This is what is maybe the best guess or understanding we have. There's a column that says co-regent. What that means is that, look at Jeroboam II, for example. He reigned from 780 to 750, but he was co-regent from 793 to 782. In other words, there was a time before he actually took the throne by himself when he shared the responsibility of king with Jehoash, the king before him. Co-regent means that he reigned with or at the same time or alongside of another. And so you can go back and read their stories and you can see how it is or why it is that it, sometimes the reign would overlap somewhat and they would they reigned for together with another king for a period of time. So on the chart, again, from Jeroboam on, from him, between him and Hosea, would be the time in Israel's history when the minor prophets were doing their work. That would be in relation to Israel. And on the, as far as the kings of Judah, from the time of Azariah down to Zedekiah would essentially be the times, or maybe even into Amaziah before him. It was during that period of time when the minor prophets were doing their work and warning the nations. So again, it's just there to give you a little bit of a context some notes as to when these events were taking place. On the other side of the page, on the back side, opposite from that chart, I've just listed some other key dates. And once again, the purpose here is to give you some context as far as the timing is concerned. When these, the writing of the prophets took place in relation to other major events that were taking place. For example, you can go back to the time when Israel first came from, or was rescued from Egypt. We believe that was in 1443 BC. That would mean that the nation of Israel came into existence as a nation with its own territory, an actual nation in that sense, in 1403 BC. That was when God brought Israel into Canaan and they began to take over the land of the Canaanites. There was a period, of course, of when Joshua and then the judges, but we'll just kind of skip over that for now for this general context to look at the nation of Israel itself. In 1047 was when Saul began to reign over Israel. David reigned over Israel from 1008 to 968 BC. It's at least of interest to note that the year that Israel and Judah separated into distinct nations was 928. at the end of Solomon's reign. This is when Israel and Judah separated into distinct nations. At that point, it was 475 years after the nation had come into existence in 1403 BC. 475 years. To consider that, we'll just consider that the United States, going back to 1776 when independence was declared, is 237 years. So Israel was had been in existence for quite some time, and then that's when they had their break in 928. We've mentioned before that it was in 721 to 718 that Israel, the nation of Israel, which is the northern nation. Now, when Israel and Judah separated, the 10 tribes of Israel were to the north, and then the tribes of Judah and Benjamin were to the south. So the northern tribes of Israel, the nation of Israel, it was the northern tribes. They fell to Assyria in the years 721 to 718, some 682 years after the nation had come into existence. In 604, Nebuchadnezzar, the leader of Babylon, invaded Judah. Actually, he personally didn't, but his nation, his armies did. Invaded Judah in 604, which is 799 years after Israel had become a nation. Drop down to 538. That was the first year of the rule of King Cyrus. At that time, he released the Jews from their captivity. You read that in Ezra, the first chapter. And not all Jews, but some, returned from Babylon back to Jerusalem. And they began the project of rebuilding the city walls and the temple. And the rebuilding of the temple was completed in the year 515. So those are a few key dates. I mentioned the 70 weeks prophecy there in 538. If you compare Daniel 9 with Ezra 1, you'll see that it was that the prophecy of the 70 weeks was given at that same time in the year 538. That's a very significant prophecy because it shows when Jesus was going to be born. As you look at that prophecy, when he would be born, when the work that he would do can be calculated, or when he would do his work from that prophecy in Daniel 9. So, as you continue studying certain details here, you can begin to add in more dates in this list, in this timeline, and I'm not going to put everything here on this one list, obviously, but you can see more where things fit in history, chronologically, some of these dates are very helpful in understanding the times in which these prophets lived and they did their work. A few notes regarding an overview of the prophets, of these of the 12 or the minor prophets. A reference that I have found to be very, very helpful is a book called The Minor Prophets, written by Charles Feinberg. And it is a book that I have used a great deal in research. Again, The Minor Prophets, Charles Feinberg. It was written in the late 1940s, early 1950s, and it's very clearly written and is a very pretty balanced approach to describing the events of the time and the meanings, significance of certain symbolism and so on. It's a very helpful book. Feinberg points out that the Hebrew canon, the original Masoretic text, divides the prophetic books into the former prophets and the latter prophets. The latter prophets include Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and the 12. The 12 became known as the minor prophets or the smaller prophets. Obviously, it wasn't because that what they wrote was not important, but because of the relative size of the books themselves. Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel are all lengthy books. Each of the 12 are very small in comparison. The 12 were kept together in a scroll, and they were identified as one book for the purpose of being sure that nothing was lost. One stray little book, for example, like Obadiah, which is just one chapter in length, could easily have become lost over time if it was left by itself. So they grouped these together, called them the 12, and that way we're very careful to preserve them. The content of these books, the 12 or the minor prophets, is wide-ranging. There are references that we will note as we go to the first coming of the Messiah. These are typically called messianic prophecies. They're the prophecies of details of the life of the one who would be the Messiah. And we find often that it will make something relating to the Messiah, and then you can find in the New Testament a corresponding verse that shows that this was a fulfillment of the original prophecy. So there are a number of messianic prophecies that we'll see as we review these books. There are, of course, the warnings of punishment to come on Israel and Judah because of their sins. That's really the body or the main part of most of the 12, the warnings to Israel and Judah, and occasionally to other nations, primarily Israel and Judah. There's also reference to the second coming of Jesus, or the kingdom of God that he will establish. So the prophecies range from the first coming to the second coming, for the punishment to the restoration in the times of the millennium. So there's quite a range of topics that is covered in these books. The books that are, as they're listed here, the order in which we are familiar is not chronological. You see that from the very beginning here, that the timeline that you've seen, the first book chronologically would be probably Joel, and then Jonah, and then Amos and Hosea and Micah. So if you looked at these books in chronological order, it would be different than the way they are listed here. There's no particular explanation for why the Jews chose to list them in this order in their efforts to preserve the books. Some have pointed out that Hosea, of course, is one of the longer books, so it may be one of the reasons it was in the front, but then so is Zechariah in its way at the back of the list. Some of them are relatively chronological. From Habakkuk on through Malachi, they're pretty much listed in order. At any rate, there's not a whole lot one complete logical explanation for the order of the books. But I'll tell you what we're going to do in our overview and explain a little bit about why. We're going to begin with the book of Hosea, and then we'll do Amos and then Micah. These are contemporary minor prophets. They lived in similar times and in some cases overlapped, at least in general. Hosea overlaps with Micah and with Amos both. So we're going to go in that order as we review them, Hosea and then Amos and then Micah. Then we're going to go back and review the book of Jonah. Jonah is about an earlier time in the history of Israel. You'll remember he was sent to warn or to prophesy against Nineveh. And when that prophecy didn't come to pass, he was extremely disappointed. But if you read the book of Nahum, that tells the rest of the story. Nahum shows what happened to Nineveh later, I think about 100 years after the time of Jonah. So Nahum is like a sequel. It'll tell you the rest of the story of Nineveh. So we'll cover Jonah and then Nahum. Then we'll pick up the books of Jonah. I'm sorry, the books of Joel and Zephaniah. Many would recognize that the theme of Joel is the day of the Lord. But it's also the theme of the book of Zephaniah. So we'll cover those two, Joel and then Zephaniah. And then, following that, we'll continue on down the timeline. We'll go to Habakkuk. Habakkuk was the last prophet to warn Judah before they were taken into captivity. Obadiah is given this date of 585. It occurred most likely, or at least by that estimate, at the time of the captivity of Judah. But the theme of the book of Obadiah is Edom, or Esau, the descendants of Esau, prophecies regarding that nation. And then we'll move on to the post-exilic books of Zechariah, Haggai, and Malachi. So that'll be the order we'll take them in. Just taking one Sabbath each month, we'll try to again go through as quickly as we can, but not rush so fast that we overlook anything that's of value or importance or some of the more challenging parts of these books to understand. I'm going to take follow Mr. Thompson's example as we continue along. You'll be able to look ahead and see what we're going to study next, and you can consider what we've covered in any particular study. If you have any questions, please send them to me. You can email them. You can write them down and hand them to me at church or ask me directly. But we'll try to take some time as we continue to answer any questions about what we've already just studied or what we're about to go into. So we can at least give you opportunity to have your questions answered about these. You've heard me often say that I can answer any question you ask, even though most of the time it's going to be, I don't know. It is at least an answer, and we'll do the best we can. Let's consider a general background of the nations of Israel and Judah in the 8th century B.C., that is from the year 799 to 700. Some of the general conditions in the nation. This was a time, of course, any given century would be unique in terms of what occurs during that time, but it was an especially pivotal time during the history of both Judah and Israel. It was during the 8th century, again between 799 and 700, that the nation of Israel was destroyed or taken into captivity by Assyria. They had been living in comparative prosperity and security, but the fall of the nation occurred very quickly after the reign of Jeroboam II. As the century progressed, Judah very nearly collapsed. We'll see a little bit of that history. But God preserved the nation of Judah for another 117 years after Israel was taken captive, after their nation was destroyed. It was again during this period of time, during the 8th century, that the writing prophets, those major and minor prophets, began to do their work. It was that century that saw the beginning of those efforts. Again, there were prophets beforehand. God worked through men. But this was another special or unique time when God sent prophets to the people to warn them of the punishment that would come if they failed to repent. It started and continued through this 8th century. The nations of Judah and Israel, as I just mentioned, were at perhaps the height of their power, of their prosperity, and their security during this century. Jeroboam II, the king of Israel, had restored much of the territory that previous kings had lost. The nation to that time was shrinking. The enemies were dominating. But we notice something interesting about how God preserved the nation of Israel in the time of Jeroboam II. Turn back to 2 Kings. Let's look at 2 Kings chapter 14. By the way, we see a principle here that I think is really important, and that is we can't really understand prophecy unless we know some history. We have to know what happened that brought Israel and Judah into these circumstances. We can see the prophecies that were made against them, and much of what we see here is, again, history, but it points to further events that will take place in the future. So prophecy and history are woven together, and you really can't understand prophecy without a pretty decent understanding of history. 2 Kings 14, verse 23. Says, in the 15th year of Amaziah, the son of Joash, king of Judah, Jeroboam, the son of Joash, a different Joash, king of Israel, Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel, began to reign in Samaria, and Jeroboam reigned for 41 years. Just a note, when we see the name Samaria in prophetic writings, that we'll see at times in the minor prophets as we continue, it refers to the nation of Israel. Samaria refers to the nation of Israel. It was their capital city and the central part of their nation. He reigned 41 years. Verse 24, he did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord. Jeroboam was an evil king. Frankly, as you look back through the history of Israel, you'll find that they had evil kings. Clear back to Jeroboam I, the first king of the divided nation of Israel. And again, by Jeroboam that's listed or spoken of here is typically in reference works called Jeroboam II, since it was also a king named Jeroboam who was the first ruler of the divided nation of Israel as it separated from Judah. Clear back to that time, Jeroboam I set up his own priesthood, established his own religion, and rejected the religion of Judah because he was fearful that the people would want to go back to Judah if they continued to have the same religion. And so from the outset, Israel has been ruled by evil kings. And Jeroboam was just one more in the line of kings who rejected God's truth and was evil in his practices. It says that he departed not from all the sins of Jeroboam, that would be Jeroboam I, the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin. But God accomplished things through Jeroboam that extended the time of Israel and also allowed them to prosper. Here's what it says of Jeroboam II. He restored the border of Israel from the entering of Hamath unto the sea of Arba, according to the word of the eternal God of Israel. God had made a promise through the prophet Jonah, we read here in this verse, that he would extend or restore the nation of Israel, and he did it through the evil king Jeroboam. For the Lord saw the affliction of Israel, verse 26, that it was very bitter, and there was not any shut up, nor any left, nor any helper for Israel. God saw that Israel, at the time that Jeroboam came into power, was in a very weak position, and there was no one there to really resolve or to help Israel through these crises. And so God himself blessed Jeroboam so that the nation of Israel would be strengthened. The Lord said, verse 27, that he would not, the Lord said not that he would blot out the name of Israel from under heaven, but he saved them by the hand of Jeroboam. So we find that to work out his plan, it's kind of a general principle that we might be able to apply in a parallel to our own situation as a nation. God will extend a nation according to his will and his timing. Jeroboam was an evil king. He did not deserve for God to step in and strengthen the nation through him. But that's what God did. It was not time yet for Israel to be punished. And so he extended and strengthened the nation through the hands of Jeroboam, or by the hand of Jeroboam. However, as they became stronger as a nation, economically, their security was strengthened, their borders were enlarged, they became more prosperous. They also, as a nation, became more evil. They continued to practice the things that God that were against God's law, but they were somehow strengthened in what they were doing because life seemed to be secure and life seemed to be good. They became more and more morally corrupt and in violation of the covenant that God had established with them, and they became more more committed to their lives because everything was going just fine. So it's into this kind of an environment that Hosea, Micah, Amos stepped in to warn them of the punishment that was going to come. And the people were just simply not in a condition or position where they were willing to receive that kind of a message. It's like they were shouting into the wind because the people thought everything was just fine. The nation was going along just very well. Everything was stable and secure and prosperous. But they were practicing evil in God's eyes. They were mistreating one another. There were moral and social sins and the rejection of God's law that was eroding their society in general. And so this was the condition of the nation as the prophets began to give warning to them. They were not of a mind to receive those kinds of messages. One thing that we, I think, assume to a certain extent as we read Old Testament prophecy is that we read into it a dual application. There's a principle of duality of prophecy. Prophecy, we see, has a fulfillment and then a latter fulfillment, or a dual application. After all, the prophets spoke of punishment to come on Israel and Judah in their day, much of which has already been fulfilled. But there will be, at the end of this age, a time of great tribulation, which will be the worst time in the history of the world. So we see that Israel and Judah were punished severely, and then at the end of the age, there will come another time of severe punishment that will be even worse than the first time. We see there a parallel between what happened to Israel and Judah and what will happen at the end of the age. There is, however, no statement that I'm aware of in Scripture which explicitly says that prophecy has a dual application. There's no specific verse that says that there will be another fulfillment of the same prophecy at the end of the age. However, that is a principle that we believe to be true. So, why is that? How do we arrive at the conclusion that there is a duality to prophecy? That it applied to Israel and Judah and will apply again at the end of the age. Well, I'll review with you a few reasons why this principle of duality is something that we see in Scripture. First of all, the prophecies are given to the tribes who are the descendants of Jacob, descendants of, effectively, of Abraham, and then through Jacob, or Israel, and then through their descendants. We know that the United States, Britain, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, these nations are direct descendants of Ephraim and Manasseh. Now, that's another study, something else that we could talk about, but it's something that we see, that the promises given to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob have been extended to the descendants of all of the sons of Israel, and in particular, Ephraim and Manasseh, the sons of Joseph. All of these nations are descendants, again, of Israel. And since they are the modern-day descendants of Israel, or the sons of Jacob, then Bible prophecies about those nations still apply to those nations. The prophecies made to the sons of Jacob apply to the sons of Jacob now as they did at that time. They still apply. They are still applicable. Because the nations that we can identify, there are nations we can identify who are the direct descendants. We'll also see then that, so when we read those prophecies, we can apply them to the descendants of Jacob even beyond the time of Israel and Judah. We'll also see as we continue that some of the prophecies that are given, including in the 12, were only partially fulfilled or have not been yet fulfilled at all. There are prophecies which were not completely fulfilled. There are prophecies which have not been fulfilled at all, that still are waiting to be fulfilled. So we see that those prophecies apply beyond the nations directly of Israel and Judah. The complete and the future fulfillment of those prophecies can only be applied to the nations to whom those prophecies were given, which again brings us back to the descendants of those tribes or those nations and into our modern times. We also see as we look at the social and religious conditions at the time of Israel and Judah, we see those conditions also exist in our time as well. Our nation has the same defiant arrogance toward God and an unwillingness to listen to and accept His instructions and His commands. The social, the moral, the religious conditions themselves are a parallel today to what Israel what we see in relation to the nations of Israel and Judah. There also are specific prophecies, which again we'll come to as we continue, of punishment that will come at the end of the age on the descendants of Jacob. And those prophecies are listed here within and part of the prophecies made against Israel and Judah. So we see a definite pattern, and we see that the prophecies that we read, and we'll note that as we continue, that the prophecies that are made to Israel and Judah have a parallel, have an application, in a sense, in effect, a duality, another application at the end of the age. So as we continue, we're going to certainly highlight the warnings that were given to Israel and Judah. We'll highlight the parallels to the end time descendants of Israel and Judah. We'll note as we go the messianic prophecies, the prophecies of the restoration of Israel and Judah, which are prophecies of the millennium, because Israel and Judah have never been restored. The nation of Israel in particular, and Judah, although the promises that are made to them, the restoration to the conditions of God that are described, have never been accomplished. We'll also, of course, as we go through, be looking for principles we can apply in our own lives, principles that apply to us. And we'll note as well key verses, or you might call them memory verses, that we'll see in each of these books as well. So the plan is to go ahead on through these minor prophets in kind of in a way that will allow us to understand them, but move along quickly as we can. Basically, the third Sabbath of each month will be a Bible study service. If there's any change from that, we'll let you know so that you can have the handouts with you as we continue. Let me take just a few more minutes, and I'm going to go ahead and begin our discussion of the book of Hosea. I'd like to go through as much here as we were able to get through this morning in Wheeling. So we've had a discussion here of the background of the prophets in general, and now let's focus just for a few minutes on the background of Hosea, and we'll try to briefly cover the first chapter of Hosea. We note from Hosea chapter 1, verse 1, that the word of the Lord came to Hosea, the son of Beeri, in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, who were kings of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel. So we have a general time frame during which Hosea made his prophecies that are shown here in this book. It's estimated that Hosea had a work that extended over approximately 50 years, five decades, from 760 B.C. to 710 B.C. However, we have a relatively short book. The book of Hosea is what? Just 14 chapters. So what we have in each of these books that represent the works is really a very brief summary of the messages that they brought. You could probably sit down and read the 14 chapters of Hosea in about 45 minutes. It wouldn't take you 50 years to review these. But these are highlights. These are perhaps summaries or perhaps specific messages that Hosea brought over the course of time. And it summarizes the work and the message that he brought to the nation, primarily of Israel. The name Hosea is a form of the name Joshua. Hosea is basically from the same root as the name Joshua, which means salvation. And Joshua is also the Old Testament equivalent of the name Jesus, the Hebrew name Jesus. So it means salvation. We know a little bit about the life of Hosea as a prophet, as an adult. We'll see in the first few chapters, but we know nothing of his background, how he was educated, how he came to be a prophet of God. We know nothing of his personal background. We know just a little bit about his life and his service as a prophet. Once again, it was a time of great physical prosperity and security. The nation was rebounding and strengthening. The people in the nation were secure, but they also were certainly very evil and had no inclination to obey, and they had no inclination to respond to the warning that Hosea brought to them. So this spiritual and moral decline is the focus of Hosea's message, as it is with the others as well. Let's read the first few chapters of first few verses of chapter 1. It says, "The Lord began to speak by Hosea, and he said, 'Go, take yourself a wife of harlotry and children of harlotry, for the land has committed great harlotry by departing from the Lord.' So he went, and he took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son." Kind of a strange instruction that was given to Hosea as God began working through him as a prophet. The indication is that Hosea was already an adult and well into his life at the time that God began to speak to him and to give him a message that he was to take to the people of Israel. Let me read from the introduction to the book of Hosea from the Life Application Bible. It says, "God told Hosea to find a wife and told him ahead of time that she would be unfaithful to him. Although she would bear many children, some of these offspring would be fathered by others." Now, that's actually something that we may take some time to explore. It's not necessarily true that some of the children of their marriage were from others, but that's the conclusion that is drawn here in this particular reference. In other words, Hosea may well have been the father of all these children, but there is some question about that. At any rate, she would bear many children. In obedience to God, Hosea married Gomer. I haven't met too many young ladies in my life named Gomer, but I guess many biblical names do sound a bit different to us. So he married a woman named Gomer, and his relationship with her, her adultery, and their children became living prophetic examples to Israel. God used this marriage and the children that came from it to represent or to symbolize part of the relationship that he would have with his nation, kind of a living metaphor of what God felt about his people and about their sins. When it says that she was a harlot, it doesn't literally mean that she was a prostitute, but it meant that she was unfaithful to her husband. And so she was loose and sexually immoral and unfaithful. The word in the Hebrew does not require that she literally was a prostitute. Continuing from the Life Application Bible introduction, says the book of Hosea is a love story, real, tragic, and true. Transcending the tale of a young man and his wife, it tells of God's love for his people and the response of his bride or the nation. A covenant had been made and God had been faithful. His love was steadfast and his commitment unbroken, but Israel, like Gomer, was adulterous and unfaithful, spurning God's love and turning instead to false gods. Then, after warning of judgment, God reaffirmed his love and offered reconciliation. His love and mercy were overflowing, but justice would be served. The nation would be punished. Now, this example of Hosea marrying Gomer, and then the children we'll read of in just a moment, it's really not necessarily evident that the people around took all that much notice of what was happening. It really is more for those who would read this story, those who would come after. May have had some impact. They may have been useful in some ways as a representation of what God was doing. But it, again, it's more effective. It's more has more of an impact on those who later, as we are, would read of what God had Hosea do. So that would at least give some hint that this message was for a time beyond Hosea, a time when others would look back on this story and learn more from it. So God had a larger idea or view of what was happening, even as this unfolded. So she conceived and bore him a son. Verse 4, then the Lord said to him, that is to Hosea, call his name Jezreel, for in a little while I will avenge the bloodshed of Jezreel on the house of Jehu, and bring an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. And it shall come to pass in that day that I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. In order to understand what these two verses are talking about, you have to understand a little bit more of the history of Israel, of this place called Jezreel. You can look and go back to 1 Kings 21. We don't have the time to do that here. Go back to 1 Kings 21, and you'll see there the story of the murder of Naboth at the hands of Ahab and Jezebel. You may remember that they wanted his vineyard, and so they were going to kill him to take possession of his vineyard. This took place at a location called Jezreel. That's where this event occurred. And it was also the place where later Jezebel died as her punishment for having caused the death of Naboth. Now, Jehu was one of the kings of Israel who had a hand in the execution of Ahab. But Jehu, even though he, in effect, kind of cleaned up the mess that Ahab had caused, was also himself a bloody man and an evil king. And so God was not pleased, even though Jehu was used to accomplish the punishment of Ahab, he was not pleased with Jehu either. Jeroboam II was a direct descendant of Jehu. And this is speaking then of the end of the kingdom of the house of Israel, the dynasty of Jehu, of which Jeroboam was a part. He was going to end that line of kings at Jezreel. It would be part of the punishment that would come upon the house of Israel. So this is a prophecy of the end of that line of kings, and in general a prophecy as well as a result of the evil and the bloodshed and the political intrigue, just the kind of nation that Israel had become, and God was going to put an end to it. So the prophecy is maybe a little bit vague, but it is of the punishment that would come upon the kingly line or the succession that had brought Jeroboam into power. Hosea was to name his son Jezreel to represent that punishment that would come. Verse 6, she conceived again and bore a daughter, and God said to him, call her name Lo-Ruhamah, for I will no longer have mercy on the house of Israel, but I will utterly take them away. Hosea's second child was to represent the time to come when God would no longer show any pity or mercy to the nation of Israel, but would bring punishment upon them. The name Lo Ruhamah literally means not pitied, or as it says here, no longer have mercy. So it's really a tough, and this is a, you know, this is a literal situation. This was Hosea's family. His wife was unfaithful to him. His children were named after disasters that were to occur in the future of Israel. Yet, and remember, now he's speaking primarily to Israel, yet I will have mercy on the house of Judah and will save them by the Lord, their God, and will not save them by bow or sword or battle or by horses or horsemen. Even though Israel would be utterly taken away, would be destroyed, the nation of Judah would still for a time be preserved. The nation of Judah would still have time to repent after Israel had been punished. Now, again, we need to understand a little bit of the history of the fall of Israel. Israel's destruction by Assyria is described in 2 Kings 17 and 18. I'll leave you to, if you'd like, to go back and read of that of the fall of Israel, and they're being taken captive and scattered. The king of Assyria who attacked Israel was Shalmaneser, mentioned in 2 Kings 18, verse 9. The next king over Assyria was Sennacherib. He's mentioned in verse 13 of 2 Kings 18. Assyria, after they attacked and destroyed Israel, was on its way to attack Judah as well. And Judah was defenseless against this Assyrian army. You may remember in 2 Kings 19 and 20 how it is that the king, Hezekiah, went before God and begged God for his mercy and for his intervention and to care for and to rescue the people. The nation of Judah could have been destroyed at the same time as the nation of Israel. But God said that he would continue to have mercy on them, even though he would no longer have mercy, Lo Ruhamah, on the nation of Israel. And they were indeed saved, not by their own strength, not by bow or sword or battle, but by direct intervention in a miracle that God performed to preserve the nation of Judah. Now you might think, if you were a person living in Judah at that time, and you saw the brutal destruction of your brother nation Israel just across, just up to the north, having been destroyed by the nation of Assyria, and Assyria on the doorstep of Judah, ready to come in and to demolish them as well. But God intervened so that it was clearly a miracle of God that provided the protection that preserved Judah. You might think that would bring some people to repentance. But it didn't work that way. Judah continued. Now they had a righteous king in Hezekiah, but beyond that, Judah continued into its continual moral decline. And 117 years later, in the year 604, Judah was invaded by Babylon by Nebuchadnezzar. So the nation of Judah, we see here in verse 7, was to be preserved for at least for a time, given more time. When she had weaned Lo Ruhamah, verse 8, she conceived and bore a son, and God said, call his name Lo Ammi, for you are not my people, and I will not be your God. Lo Ammi, or Lo Ammi, means not my people. for the sake or for the time of their punishment, God would turn his back on his people to allow them to be punished. It wasn't that they were literally no longer his people. God had made an unconditional promise to Abraham to preserve his descendants, but they had not lived up to their duties to obey God, and he punished them, turned his back on them as they were punished. And yet, verses 10 and 11, even after this description of terrible destruction and punishment to come upon Israel, when they would no longer be his people, that he would no longer show pity to them, that he would allow them to come into this terrible time of punishment, yet, it says in verse 10, the number of the children of Israel shall be as the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured or numbered. So it leaps clear ahead then to the time of the restoration of Israel, which is the time of the millennium. It skips from this time in 700 BC all the way beyond all of the history that's taken place since then, ahead of us, to the time of the millennium, because this is certainly a prophecy which has not been fulfilled. At least not fulfilled completely. The descendants of Abraham have had great blessings through the ages, and especially since the late 19th century, late 18th century forward. They have not been blessed in the way that is described here fully and completely. It shall come to pass in the place where it was said to them, you are not my people, there it shall be said to them, you are sons of the living God. His mercy would return to them. Rather than being those who were denied being his people, they would be called the sons of God. Then the children of Judah and the children of Israel shall be gathered together and appoint for themselves one head, and they shall come up out of the land, for great will be the day of Jezreel. Jezreel used in a completely different sense, a time of great blessing and a time of restoration of the people. And so we see in this first chapter a pretty good summary of the approach that God takes through Hosea, expressing the terrible punishment that is to come upon them, but contrasted by the love and the compassion that God has, that immediately after describing the destruction comes the description of the restoration and of the love that God expresses toward his people. And in this sense, God used the nation, or the marriage, I should say, of Hosea and his family to represent what was happening in the relationship between Israel and their God, and he would use that to show how he would deal with them, and also calling upon some of the events of history that the people were familiar with. So that's where we're going to stop now. Next time we go back into this, I hope to be able to get through much of the rest of the book of Hosea. We will find in it another couple of chapters that relate to Hosea personally, and then from chapter 4 on, we find a description of more of a declaration type of the prophecies that Hosea makes of the punishment and also the restoration that God will bring ultimately. So we've made it through the introductory material and into the first of the books, and we'll pick it up from that point the next time we have a study.